Divinization and the Gradation of Freedom. For the sake of an inclusio with the first talk about the image of God, I want to start with a citation from St. John Damascene, the Greek theologian who was very important to St. Thomas. I mentioned that he quotes John Damascene at the beginning of the Secunda Pars, which is about man's motion back into God. In question 93 on the image of God in the Prima Pars, St. Thomas quotes Damascene saying this: "Man's being in God's image signifies his capacity for understanding and for making free decisions in mastery of self. That he is in his likeness refers to the likeness of divine virtue insofar as it can be in man." Divine virtue. One of the major questions of this talk is, what is divine virtue? And is it something that belongs on a scale with human virtue? And what does that mean? We could start by interrogating the concept of divine virtue by asking, who has divine virtue? Presumably, it means that God has virtue. But does God have virtue? In one simple sense, yes, God has virtue. You could look at the Latin word virtus, which means power. So we heard how the Greek concept of arete for virtue means something more like battlefield courage. In Latin, it's more associated with power, virtus. God has power. You can think, for example, of Christ, the power of God, from the letter to the Romans. But in moral discourse, we consider virtue in a special sense. Virtue is a settled disposition of the rational soul. It's a disposition to act in accord with reason. It involves choice and deliberation. It requires education. It regards certain objects one at a time. Different virtues regard certain objects. So in this sense, we might want to say, no, God doesn't have virtue. Virtue is something that's conditioned by our life in time, the complexity of our life, whereas God's life is simple. The main objection in the Western tradition comes from Aristotle himself. So Aristotle says, speaking about the gods, but we could also say a fortiori, that this applies to God. The gods, Aristotle says, what sort of actions can we attribute to them? Just actions? But will it not seem ridiculous to think of them as making contracts, restoring deposits, and the like? Then brave actions, enduring terrors, and running risks for the nobility of doing so, or liberal actions. But to whom will they give? Besides, it would be absurd to suppose that they actually have coinage or currency of some sort. And temperate actions, what will these mean in their case? Surely it would be derogatory to praise them for not having evil desires. If we go through the list, we shall find that all forms of virtuous conduct seem trifling and unworthy of the gods. So Aristotle thinks that gods do not have virtues, and that especially the prime mover, the one God of the cosmos, doesn't have virtue. In a way, we can hear his polemic against Plato, that the forms, being an idea of separate divine substances, are not accessible to our minds such that we can speak of ourselves and them in the same way. We need some connection to form which is earthier or practical, from which we abstract in immaterial knowledge. Christian theologians turned to this problem in the Middle Ages, the High Middle Ages, and in the 13th century, we find them reaching especially to Plotinus for a solution. And this is interesting. We don't see a lot of Plotinus necessarily, especially in direct quotations. But look at the first quotation on your handout under Roman numeral 1. So this is from the Prima Secundae, question 61, article 5. And it's the sed contra, which means that Thomas is using this as an authority to pose a question to the question. The question is, are the cardinal virtues suitably divided in this way? And then we'll hear what this way is. So Macrobius says in Super Somnium Scipionis, on the dream of Scipio, Plotinus, together with Plato, foremost among teachers of philosophy, says, the four kinds of virtue are fourfold. In the first place, there are the political virtues. Second, there are the purifying virtues. Third, there are already purified virtues. And fourth, there are exemplar virtues. So this talk is based largely on this citation and how St. Thomas reacts to it. We see here a Neoplatonic fourfold schema of the virtues that was current in Aquinas' time. Political, purifying could be translated other ways. Cathartic is one way, or purgative. And then purified, the literally already purged mind, iam purgati animi. So the same ambiguity, purification, catharsis, perfection even. And then fourthly, exemplar. So this idea of exemplar virtue is how we're going to navigate the problem that Aristotle has posed. God as being exemplar. Thomas was not overly fond of this fourfold schema. If you'd studied Thomas before, you probably haven't heard of this. He prefers other ways of categorizing the virtues in general. This question comes right at the end of his consideration of the cardinal virtues. So the cardinal virtues, again, are the two virtues that govern the sensible appetites, temperance and fortitude, the virtue that governs the rational appetite, the will, that is justice, and the intellectual virtue, which is about right reason, about things to be done. So we've gone over that several times in this retreat. Recta ratio agibilium. So the cardinal virtues are general, and under them, Thomas places all different kinds of virtues. The cardinal virtues appear, first of all, in Plato, and in the Republic, he considers these four as somehow primary. And it's also there where he drops this phrase, political virtues. Someone is asking him a question, and he says, oh, I just mean the political version. So the Platonic tradition took this comment and they said, well, Plato thinks there's a distinction between political virtues and higher forms of virtues. In the Phaedo, he talks about a form of virtue which is purifying. So then that's the basis for coming up with categories of virtues which are political, then purifying, and then looking at them in terms of his idea of forms, exemplar causes. One important place in St. Thomas that this does occur, besides here and in his sentences commentary, is in an interesting sermon called Hic Est Liber. So Hic Est Liber, we don't know exactly what it is, but we think pretty surely it's by St. Thomas. And it's a commentary in some way, or a sermon based on this text from Baruch. This is the book of the commandments of God. So medieval scholars would take this verse and they would say, now I'm going to preach about the book, the Bible, and I'm going to tell you how it's organized. And as he's giving his organization, he comes to the wisdom books. And he uses this fourfold division to categorize the wisdom books. So Proverbs. Proverbs is about the political virtues. Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is about virtues that purify. Song of Songs. This is about virtues as perfected. And then he says, what book goes with the exemplar virtues? None. There's no book that goes with the exemplar virtues. They are directly from God, not through the Bible. So I'll give some reasons why I think this is an important division and why we should consider this fourfold division, even though it's not big in the world of Thomism. This is a spirituality of virtue. It's a philosophically dense spirituality of virtue. Why is virtue attractive? We talk about it making us happy. We talk about it ruling our lives and giving us order. But ultimately, we believe that virtue makes us like God. It makes us God-like. Ultimately, we believe that virtue will help us to share in the life of God. And that's happiness, not anything in this life. So we need something like this, I think. It also provides a sort of unintuitive way of thinking about freedom. God is not free in the way that we normally think of freedom. Our difficulties with freedom, which we've discussed a lot during this retreat, do not apply in the same way to God, for whom everything is immediately accessible. There's no difficulty in acting. There's no ignorance, which would cause a need for deliberation. So freedom works differently. But I think we can see this on a scale of ascending kinds of freedom, where our freedom is imperfect and engaged in many things, but it becomes more simple and more powerful and more divine as we ascend through these different stages of the fourfold schema. And finally, I think it also gives us a new way to think about this idea of form of life or states of life. Why are there different states of life which suddenly make us see everything differently? The married state versus the religious state. The active state versus the contemplative state. What is the meaning of there being different states? And how can we apply the same virtues to all of those, but with distinctions? I'm not going to be able to give an exhaustive explanation of that, but by the end, I want to propose a way of looking at different states of life under this fourfold schema. So again, St. Thomas is not the most enthused about this, but in his Collationes in Hexameron, St. Bonaventure devotes a lot of space to this. He quotes Macrobius at length. He quotes him for like 10 paragraphs. So Bonaventure was preaching to theologians, and he was giving conferences on the creation. And he gets to a point where he wants to just take Aristotle out to the woodshed. He thinks Aristotle is pretty smart, but makes a lot of serious errors. Most importantly, he thinks that Aristotle did not understand exemplar causality. Exemplar causality is something that St. Thomas cares about. So if you look at the second text on your handout, Roman numeral 2, this is the same question, question 61, article 5, and St. Thomas begins by talking about not the political, but the exemplar virtues. He says, accordingly, virtue may be considered as existing originally in God, and thus we speak of exemplar virtues. You can see that in Latin, est exemplariter in Deo. So virtue is exemplarily in God. So that in God, the divine mind itself may be called prudence, while temperance is the turning of God's gaze on himself, even as in us it is that which conforms the appetite to reason. God's fortitude is his unchangeableness. His justice is the observance of the eternal law in his works, as Plotinus states. Again, Plotinus is not all over the Summa. Plotinus is someone who we don't hear much from in St. Thomas. So let's just take a second to consider what's going on in this text from Macrobius and why this Plotinian resolution is important. So Macrobius was a Latin Neoplatonist. He was writing in Latin in the 4th and 5th centuries. And He was giving a synthesis of what had gone before in debates between the Platonists and the Aristotelians, which resolved itself in many ways in the school of Plato. So the school of Plato was predominant in the ancient philosophical world. The Platonists, the Middle Platonists, and sometimes the Neoplatonists are how we talk about. There are different phases to this, but they all saw themselves as continuing the academy. The Platonic Academy continued until 529 AD, with pagan philosophers trying to study Plato, at which point the Christian emperor, shut it down. He's like, we've got it from here. But so there was this mutual academic engagement with the Christians and the Platonists. And the Platonists would read Aristotle. They had a curriculum where they were going towards the dialogues. They wanted to read the dialogues most of all. But in order to prepare themselves, they would read Aristotle and they would read Stoics. So Aristotle was considered to be a kind of propedeutic. Plotinus then was a major Platonist teacher who was kind of charismatic and brought a lot of people into his sway. He was a fellow student with the Christian theologian Origen, most likely. And he writes a work on the virtues, where he raises this question explicitly. He says, for Plato, there are divine virtues, but Aristotle says there aren't. So what do we do with that? Plotinus gives an account of the virtues that's like this one we have here. The one we have here, though, is a little bit different. It actually comes from Porphyry. So Porphyry was a student of Plotinus, and Macrobius took Porphyry and he said, here's the teaching of Plotinus. So close enough. Plotinus was a little bit more discursive. He was kind of, it was a conversation. So as far as the exemplar virtues goes, he's a little bit more flowery, and it's harder to pin down exactly what he's saying. So you can see why the medievals would like this more succinct formulation. And C.S. Lewis actually has a good commentary on this Macrobius text. So in The Discarded Image, which is a book about the cosmology that was behind medieval and Renaissance literature, he goes through some of these late Neoplatonists and he says, look, they had already resolved a lot of the problems between Plato and Aristotle. Or if they hadn't resolved them, they had at least syncretized them. So he calls them syncretist. So Macrobius takes the difficulties of Aristotle and Plato and he presents them in a way which later Christians can look at and sort of say, oh, okay, this idea is half-baked. We're going to try to bake it all the way. The funny thing about the commentary of Macrobius is that it's a commentary on Cicero. So Cicero is narrating the dream of this political guy named Scipio. Scipio is having a dream where he sees heaven. And in heaven, there's all these political men, all these senators and generals. And Cicero is basically trying to say, heaven is for the great political men. So as he's describing this heaven, he sort of drops a little aside. He says, the greatest happiness that we can have on this earth. And he goes on to say something else. Macrobius, coming centuries later, takes that little phrase and he pounces on it. He says, oh, that was just the greatest happiness we can have on earth. But of course, there are more divine forms of happiness. And that is where we have Plotinus. So Plotinus talks about how political life is something which you ultimately need to leave behind. He says, political life will not make you divine. It will not make you happy. In Macrobius, we find someone saying yes to both of those options. Political life is of the utmost importance. Divine life is of the utmost importance. It's a tension, but I think it becomes very useful in the Middle Ages in a different context. So St. Thomas receives this syncretistic vision and he applies it to his time where there are different kinds of perfection in the church. There are different forms of life, where the virtues, the same virtues, the cardinal virtues, are lived out, but at different levels. Most important for understanding this is probably exemplar cause. What is exemplar causality? And how do exemplar virtues exert a pull on the political virtues that brings them to higher and higher levels of purification and perfection? So exemplar cause. If you know Aristotle's four causes, you know that this is not one of them. So exemplar cause is like final cause, but its effect, instead of the good, is the true. And it's also like formal cause, except that instead of being in the thing, it's in the mind of the one who made the thing. So this is an explanation that comes from Dominican Thomas Gilby from England. Another way of saying it is a formal causality that is configured by final causality. So it's a formal causality, but the form is in a divine sort of place, and it's drawing the one who has the form. This Neoplatonist modification of Aristotelian cause already has the look of an ascent from the less perfect form to the more perfect form. But it's stated in kind of Aristotelian causal categories. Now, what about freedom? How does freedom fit into this? Plotinus puts great emphasis on the fact that the ultimate freedom of the soul is not a freedom of choice. Because having to choose is actually a form of weakness, he says. Quote, to be capable of opposites belongs to incapacity to remain with the best. To be capable of opposites belongs to an incapacity to remain with the best. Do we find this to be the case for St. Thomas as well? Do we have a divine freedom which exercises an exemplar causality? Recall the Summa Theologiae's Secunda Pars and the prologue, where Thomas writes, now that the exemplar has been spoken of, namely God, and those things which proceed from the divine power according to his will, it remains that we should consider his image, that is, man, insofar as he too is the principle of his own works, as having free will and power over his works. Principium suorum operum, I think I said actuum the other day, the principle of his own opera, and having free will, liberum arbitrium. So it's clear that in the Summa, St. Thomas does have this idea that God is an exemplar. We begin with God, and God is drawing us higher to himself through what we share with him. Is what we share with him virtues? It seems like it is, because that's where the Secunda Pars is going. The Secunda Pars is about acts, and the first part of it, the prima secundae, is about the principles of acts. The second part of it is about acts themselves, and it's organized according to the virtues. Faith, hope, love, temperance, fortitude, justice, prudence. Maybe not in that order, I can't remember. Okay, let's look first at an earlier text to see a place where St. Thomas addresses this fourfold schema. Look at the third text on your sheet. This is from his commentary on the sentences. So the obligatory commentary that masters in theology had to do. The virtues that perfect in the active life, even the acquired ones, it is not fitting that they be removed when someone is transferred to the contemplative life. So he's talking about whether the virtues that you had before entering religious life are going to form you in the same way when you enter a contemplative life. Maybe not even speaking of religious life and lay life, but different modes of transfer. So one transfer to the contemplative life would be death. You will eventually enter the contemplative life, whether you want to or not. Okay, but they have different acts insofar as they pertain to a proximate end. Because the contemplative life is the end of the active life. And therefore, Macrobius distinguishes three grades of these virtues insofar as they are in men. So here he says it's Macrobius. He doesn't say Plotinus, prince of the philosophers along with Plato, but that is a fun phrase. They are political, insofar as man is rectified in civil matters by them. Purifying, insofar as someone pants after the quiescence of contemplation while still making use of civic things. There St. Thomas is using a word that Gregory the Great loved, panting, anhelare. But they are purified insofar as someone, having cast off all the business of civic life, is wholly dedicated to the quiescence of contemplation. So you see what St. Thomas is doing here. If we have this contrast between Cicero, who says political life is the way to heaven, and Plotinus, who says a divine contemplative life is the way to heaven, St. Thomas is saying yes to both of them. There's a later consideration of this fourfold scheme of virtues, and I didn't include it on your handout because it's long, but I'll read through it. It's from the same question, question 61. Again, St. Thomas is considering the cardinal virtues, and he's already said, yes, first of all, they're in God. So he starts up at the top of the four-rung ladder. And then he goes back down to the bottom. Some people will say that this is his sort of nod to Aristotle, the master. You know, he's disagreeing with the master. He's saying, we'll begin with exemplar virtues because I think that's important. Next, we'll go to the political virtues. Why? Because that is our nature. Our nature is political. If you read this question in the common translations that we have of the Summa, you'll see translations like the social virtues or the civic virtues. The English friars were kind of backing off from the word political, the way we tend to back off from the word political. But we are, Aristotle says, political animals, meaning we live in a city, or made for the life of a city. What is a city? Hard to say. Aristotle's city was very different from Washington, D.C., but the point is that it's part of our nature to live in society. So, exemplar virtues, back down to the bottom with political virtues, and then he's going to say, we do ascend. We do ascend towards God through these intermediate purifying virtues. And this is what he says further on in the body of question 61, article 5. But since it behooves a man to do his utmost to strive onward even to divine things, as even the philosopher declares in Ethics, Book 10. So he's got Aristotle. He says, Aristotle, you say that we need to ascend to the divine things through contemplation. And as Scripture often admonishes us, for instance, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. From Matthew 5. Because of those, we must needs place some virtues between the political or human virtues and the exemplar virtues which are divine. Now these virtues differ by reason of a difference of movement and term, so that some are virtues of men who are on their way and tending toward the divine similitude. These are called perfecting virtues. So those who are on the way tending to perfect virtue. Thus, now he's going to explain how each of the virtues are perfecting or purifying. The second rung. Thus, prudence, by contemplating the things of God, counts as nothing all things of the world and directs all the thoughts of the soul to God alone. Temperance, so far as nature allows, neglects the needs of the body. Fortitude prevents the soul from being afraid of neglecting the body and rising to heavenly things. And justice consists in the soul giving a wholehearted consent to follow the way thus proposed. So it's about leaving behind. We'll talk a little bit more about what is being left behind in a little bit. Besides, there are the virtues of those who have already attained to the divine similitude, and these are called the perfect virtues. So now the third rung, the perfected, the already perfect. Thus, prudence sees nothing else but the things of God. Sees the things of God. Temperance knows no earthly desires. Fortitude has no knowledge of passion. And justice, by imitating the divine mind, is united thereto by an everlasting covenant. Such are the virtues attributed to the blessed, the saints in heaven, or in this life, to some who are at the summit of perfection, the most perfect life. So he's talking about not only the saints, but even some in this life achieve a purified virtue, a divine virtue. The political virtues are characterized mostly as having to do with the passions. So for St. Thomas, politics involves virtue, and virtue is about the governance of the passions. Especially the moral virtues, temperance, fortitude, and justice, and particularly the two that have to do with sense appetites, temperance and fortitude. Our life with one another and in the world is about moderating the passions. So it seems kind of funny, in fact, to hear St. Thomas saying that there's a kind of virtue which goes beyond passion. He takes great pains in other places to explain why virtues do have to moderate the passions, why we don't want to kill the passions or root them out, but rather order them, form them, make them do the bidding of reason. They need to become the servants, the willing servants of the reason. And in fact, Thomas talks about how reason exercises a political rule over the passions. So St. Thomas uses political language to talk about the soul. Of course, this has a Platonic overtone. The political rule, this comes from Aristotle too, though, means it has to convince the passions. It has to use rhetoric in a sort of metaphorical way to convince the passions to do things willingly, as opposed to a despotic or tyrannical rule. So there's a political life that's interior to us, and it has to do with the passions. We can also look at political life as we normally understand it, as having to do with the passions. Rhetoric, moral fortitude, the bases of political participation and influence, they are not that rational. They're primarily about the governance of the passions. So that's something that I think we can see St. Thomas talking about the political in terms of the passions throughout his treatise on man. Some people will say Thomas doesn't have that much of an interest in politics. That's sort of true. He's more interested in the contemplative life. But whenever he's talking about the passions, he's talking about the political. And what about the exemplar virtues? Where did Thomas tell us about the exemplar virtues? He says that in the Prima Pars, he's already talked about the exemplar. He's already talked about God. In a big way, that has to do with creation, the flowing of creation from God in a certain sense called production or animation, emanation, excuse me, but most properly creation, only God creates. But in the beginning of the Prima Pars, he goes through a lot of different things that are virtues. Like he asks, does God have fortitude or temperance when he's talking about what can we know about God? And he usually says, well, yes, metaphorically. He usually does back off from saying that God has temperance, fortitude, and justice in the sense of virtue. But there's one big text that's important, question 22 in the Prima Pars, and that's about providence. So the way that St. Thomas helps us understand providence is with an etymology that providence is related to prudence. Providentia, prudentia. This is a traditional observation that there's a similarity going on there. In question 22, he says, the type of things ordered towards an end is, properly speaking, providence. For it is the chief part of prudence to which two other parts are directed, namely, remembrance of the past and understanding of the present. Inasmuch as, from the remembrance of what is past and the understanding of what is present, we gather how to provide for the future. Now it belongs to prudence, according to the philosopher Aristotle in the Ethics, chapter 6, to direct other things towards an end, whether in regard to oneself, as for instance, a man is said to be prudent, who orders well his acts toward the end of life, or in regard to others subject to him in a family, city, or kingdom. Talked about how St. Thomas has different subjective parts of prudence, subjective forms, where we dispose ourselves towards the family or to the kingdom, etc. In which sense it is said, a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord has appointed over his family. So remember, we're talking about providence, but St. Thomas is going into prudence. In this way, prudence or providence may suitably be attributed to God. For in God himself, there can be nothing ordered towards an end, since he is the last end. This type of order in things towards an end is therefore in God called providence. Whence Boethius, a Christian Neoplatonist, says, in the Consolation of Philosophy, Boethius says that providence is the divine type itself. Ipsa divina ratio. Providence is the divine type itself, seated in the supreme ruler, which disposes all things. Which disposition may refer either to the type of the order of things toward an end, or to the type of the order of parts in the whole. So besides this one article about the fourfold division of the virtues, it might be hard to say for St. Thomas whether all of the virtues are in God as exemplars. There's a recent pair of articles in the journal Theological Studies arguing over this very thing. When St. Thomas talks about these exemplar virtues and referring specifically to this citation from Macrobius, does he really mean it? Or is he presenting an idea of prudence as a virtue, sort of, and denying divine ideas in God because that's too Platonist for him? So this is a live question. But with providence, we see that, yes, definitely, the virtues of prudence, insofar as they come under the idea of providence, are in God. Then we could think of another example. Christ as an exemplar. So what is Christ? Christ is God who became man. Why did he become man? Partly to give us a moral example that we could follow, but also so that his human life would be an object of meditation, an object of contemplation. So when we contemplate on the life of Christ, we are changed by its power. The things that Jesus did and suffered instruct us, and they change us. His whole sacred humanity, you could say, is an exemplar cause. This is another thing that I'm not sure that St. Thomas says that exactly, but many who study him say it seems that he sees Christ as an exemplar cause. And so that's why he, before anyone else had thought of this approach, went through the life of Christ part by part, event by event, and analyzed it in a scholastic mode because he thought this is intelligible. God is instructing us, and if God is instructing us, that means that the divine mind is leading us out of ourselves, above this earth and its passions, and into a perfect divine virtue. Now again, Aristotle doesn't think that the divine virtues are virtues in God himself, but in the Ethics, there's a funny moment in Book 7 where he's finished talking about the moral virtues. He's given his sort of clearest account of how virtues works, and he says, let's make a new beginning, because there's different things in the moral life that are harder to take account of. And he says one of them is heroic or divine virtues. So for Aristotle, there are divine virtues. They're the virtues of men who seem to become almost like gods. He admits that some virtues seem to be governed by a principle that is above nature. So in the Greek tradition, we see men becoming like gods. And Aristotle seems to be taking that seriously. He doesn't really give us a lot more about what he means, but he does proceed to the contemplative life where men become divine through contemplation. So the heroic virtues are a weird thing in Aristotle that Christians also pick up on. And they're associated especially with the gifts of the Holy Spirit. So we've talked about the gifts of the Spirit. That there are habitus of the soul, the rational soul, which are directed not by a principle interior to the human, but by a divine principle, the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit gives gifts, but they are not to be used at the whim necessarily of the individual. It's a prompting of the Spirit, an instinctus, a prompting, a movement, direct movement of the Spirit, which engages them. So the Christian tradition sort of sees this category in Aristotle and says, oh, these are heroic or divine virtues. Look at text 4 on your handout. So this is in the Tertia Pars, which is about Christ. And the question is, did Christ have virtues in his human soul? Because you might say, no, he was divine. He didn't need human virtues. St. Thomas disagrees. A heroic or godlike habit only differs from virtue commonly so called by a more perfect mode, inasmuch as one is disposed to good in a higher way than is common to all. Hence, it is not hereby proved that Christ had not the virtues, but that he had them most perfectly beyond the common mode. In this sense, Plotinus gave to a certain sublime degree of virtue the name of virtue of the purified soul. So, again, I am just picking out the very few times that St. Thomas uses this fourfold schema. This is the answer to an objection. And he finds this category in Plotinus useful and relates it to the heroic or godlike virtue that Aristotle talks about. Not the gifts of the Holy Spirit in this instance, but a certain sublime degree of virtue that's the virtue of the purified soul. So at this point, we can leave the question of St. Thomas and the exegesis of St. Thomas aside and just sort of go on to this fourfold schema in itself. I think that it's useful for uniting some of the considerations of this retreat. So on the handout, there's a section entitled Thesis. So this is not the kind of thesis that you want to have for a paper because it's just a list of words. But I'm going to propose a way of looking at this fourfold scheme as addressing this question of forms of life and the way that we can advance in virtue and thereby advance in freedom. Okay, so looking at the political virtues again. The political virtues have to do with the moderation of passions. They have to do with technology, techne. So we heard some things about Heidegger. One of Heidegger's important works is a commentary on Plato's Sophist. But in the commentary on Plato's Sophist, for some reason, he starts out by talking about Aristotle's ethics. He focuses on book 6 of the ethics and on the intellectual virtues. He especially wants to focus on techne, which is art, artifice, the intellectual virtue of art, and phronesis, which is the Greek word for prudence. And he's interested in these because he sees something developing about man's disposition towards things, which is a big concern of his. There's another book called What is a Thing? And how they are something which he sees as instrumental to him or not instrumental to him, and how his world is made up of different habits of thought which allow him to either receive things as ready at hand, standing reserve, as Dr. Madden was talking about, or something else, letting beings be. I'm not that concerned with Heidegger. That's not a good representation of what he says. But the point being that the virtues have a lot to do with how we regard things. The manipulation of things, the development of greater power over things through technology, is political. So we see that very clearly in our time. And I would just propose again that we should see this as involving the passions. So to consider technology with reference to the passions means that technology is not a thing in itself. There's disputes over how is technology neutral? People want to say it's neutral. It matters how you use it. Yes, in a rationally distinct way, that's true. But if we consider the fact that techne is a virtue, it's united in a certain complicated way to the moral virtues. That's why it's distinguishable, but not something which can be totally differentiated from them. Then our technological life is wrapped up in our political life of the passions. And it's sort of very clear how this works just on a simple level. Screens, manipulation, the deadening of our souls through our use, our poor use of the means that we have at our disposal. I say it's clear. It's not clear exactly what to do with all of this, but to see that there is a realm of virtue, which is about the governance of the passions, and that should be, in a way, how we look at technology, not as what it is in itself. You could even say it doesn't exactly have a what it is in itself. It's always keyed. It's always tied to the passions and the political life which they govern. Okay, and then determination. So I'm going to begin to talk about the ramifications for freedom. In the political level of the virtues, there's a determination of the body, which is always tied to the exercise of the virtues. The way that the ancients would have looked at this is that this is all going on in a kind of sublunar realm. Our bodies are being moved, and our bodies are moving other bodies. This is a part of the exercise of political life and of virtue. And in a certain way, there's a determination to that. Matter has limits, and it's determined to certain forms, and there are limits beyond which it cannot go. That's why virtue can't just dismiss the passions, but needs to rule them, because they are the members of the rational soul. So there is a certain determinism. And Professor Madden, I think, put this very well, that there's a determinism to our lives on Earth, our communities, our bodies, which means that our access to the contemplative realm of the vision of God and of rational concepts, mathematical concepts, is limited, and in fact almost entirely determined on a certain level. Again, a sort of sublunar, earthly level. But then we can move on to the purifying virtues, and we can see that that determination begins to be kind of beat up as we purify ourselves. So the purifying virtues, it's interesting to think about these as forms of life. That there would be forms of life, whether marriage or religious life or intellectual life, as our previous conference discussed, that there's an intellectual life which entails certain habits of living, and that these forms of life would give us access to a sort of new menu of the virtues. The same virtues, but in a higher mode. This is an imperfect conformity to the divine. So this is just like a very clear thing. When you're living a life where you're coming from political virtue, the governance of the passions, and you're moving towards an idea of godliness, that you're imperfect. So part of what's entailed in these forms of life, which are characterized by purifying virtue, is imperfection. Imperfection is an important mark. It's even like, so in that comment, that sentences phrase, we sort of see that someone is panting after the quiescence of contemplation while still making use of civic things. So there's effort. It's hard. You're panting after the contemplative life means like you never have enough time to do it. You're always failing. If that's a mark of these forms of life, that means that if you are failing, you're doing it right. So the purifying virtues involve a partial vision of a higher form of virtue while still moving in the realm of the passions and of what needs to be freed. Desire, then. desire is a characteristic of this. So desire is good. And a desire to let this life lapse in a certain sense. It doesn't sound safe to let this life lapse. To stop making use of civic things doesn't sound prudent. But if we're saying that the virtues exist at a higher mode, then in fact you can say it is prudent. It's prudent to desire something outside of this world. There will be political objections to that. That it's irresponsible. But this desire for the things seen is constitutive of a higher mode of virtue, which means that you can respond to the political objections by saying, yes, it is prudent, but it's prudent in a higher mode. Someone who only believes in the political level of the virtues, and there's probably some Thomists and Aristotelians who would want to make that limitation, might not see that. Okay. The purified virtues. These are characterized not so much by desire, but by rest. So we can see that in the Blessed, for sure. We can see that if we meditate on Christ and how he had a vision of the Father, that Christ was enjoying the vision of the Father. He was resting in the Father even while he was working. He talks about his work, finishing the work that he was sent to do. But he's also resting because he is divine. So there is a note of rest. But, as we heard, one of the versions of this is a contemplative life, a most perfect life still here on earth. So not total rest. Nor did Christ have total rest. Christ, while he enjoyed vision perfectly, also suffered the human desires, the longing for God, which brought him to prayer. And then perfect conformity to and participation in providence. So, there he is again. I talked about the determinism of political virtue. Providence is the exemplar that we should pair with that determinism. So in this world, there's a governance by determined causes in which we begin to understand our freedom with respect to them. But in conforming ourselves to providence in our minds, we begin to transcend that determinism. There's a conformity to providence which is accessible through these purified virtues in a way that we begin to participate in the work of God himself. So this is why there has to be a notion of different grades of freedom. We have to be able to acknowledge that our freedom is limited by the determinations of the flesh. But at the same time, if we do think that there are exemplar virtues and we already participate in them, then we have to acknowledge too that there is a complication here. We are determined, and yet we are not determined. When we act in conformity to God, we somehow escape the determination of the sublunar or the impassioned life. We somehow begin to already taste this higher freedom. And it's that freedom that Plotinus talks about. So see again this quotation from Plotinus. To be capable of opposites belongs to an incapacity to remain with the best. So to be incapable of doing evil is actually, for Aristotle, one of the marks of virtue. To be incapable of acting evilly. A virtuous person might feel like they can do a bad thing, but they can't. So to have this fixity of will, to be participating already in a perfect providence, is a mark of the virtues, but the virtues at a higher level than simply prudence, simply human or political prudence. Political prudence will not experience this providential dimension, I don't think. And then I just want to bring up briefly, by way of conclusion, that there's a disagreement in the school of the Neoplatonists. So Porphyry taught that our participation in the divine life was one where we had a sort of doubleness, a life here and a life in heaven. And that sounds a little bit like what I was just saying. But there was another Neoplatonist who followed after him named Iamblichus. And he believed, well, there is a truth to the fact that we are fully descended into this world of determined causes, this world of, for them, fate. But the gods, the divine, have sent to us, they've given us symbols which have power to unite us to a higher realm. And if that sounds like Catholic sacramental theology, that's because Iamblichus influenced Proclus, who was a leader of the Platonic Academy, came after Iamblichus. And Proclus was a big influence on St. Thomas. So Proclus's idea of causality, that God causes by means of secondary causes, influenced St. Thomas's theology of the sacraments, that the sacraments are true causes, which cause by participation in a human mode with movements of grace. So this is how Iamblichus talks about it. He uses this term theurgy, which means the work of God. Watch out for this word. Augustine has a whole book in the City of God where he talks about how evil theurgy is. And that's the meaning of theurgy, that it's like we are working on God. We're influencing God, changing his mind. And he says that's ridiculous. But there's another meaning of theurgy. That is that God is working. Not work on God, but the work of God. And that's Iamblichus's sense. The whole of theurgy presents a double aspect. On the one hand, it is performed by men, and as such, observes our natural rank in the universe. But on the other, it controls divine symbols, and in virtue of them is raised up to union with the higher powers and directs itself harmoniously in accordance with their dispensation. It invests itself by virtue of ineffable symbols with the hieratic role of the gods. I'm not recommending polytheistic rituals, but that said, the control of divine symbols, what is that? God has given us symbols, physical symbols, which we use to engage in acts of worship by our own will. And when we engage in those, we participate in the work of God. And think about the fact, I mean, some have talked about this, you don't necessarily feel something when you participate in a sacrament. Is that okay? Yes, because the passions belong to our realm of life. It's good that they would be reformed by the sacraments. But what's happening is according to a higher mode, another mode of causality, in union with the higher powers, directed harmoniously in accordance with their dispensation, their providence, you could say. Okay, so in the sacraments, we have a share in the causality of God, whose providence invites a free conformity. So the conformity to God's providence is not a determination. It's not a determination to God's will in the sense that we are sometimes determined by uncontrollable things in this world, the passions, political causes. Instead, it is a fixity in the divine good. And so in ascending through grades of virtue, we're seeking a fixity in the divine good. Thank you.